So could we give a very warm ovale welcome to John McKinnon?
Collins says you should always begin by telling people how long you're going to read for, so that they don't get frightened. About 25 minutes. I'm going to read from the last two collections, starting with Where Sadness Begins. And his first poem is called Bog Woman. And it's based, I lived for a number of years on the edge of the bog in Kildare. So we'll see how well this travels down to Cork. Bog Woman. Something about her harks back to the bog and a moonlit summer night with the sky opening itself to whatever the darkness offers. Something in the sad momentary drift of her eyes through the window hints at a day in February, perhaps the last day of that month, when the weather was wild as nakedness, the wind tossing madly, and no one could even guess at the pain inside her heart. She goes on searching for the laughter, the promise of this long summer night. A summer Sunday at the start of singing June, wet and warm, the sky a ball of lead. I see her on the lane, her red umbrella a shelter from the rain, from the possibility of life. Each afternoon she walks this path to the very end, to where the tar gives way and sinks into the faltering hardcore and then into the 90,000 years of turf and history, with its bride's bouquets of columbine, its chronicles of groping love, backbroken labour and weighted flesh, buried like stones in black bog holes by one passion or another. And she never ventures out onto the bog. Instead, she looks and turns and walks back to her garden and her God. One time, a long time ago, a man spoke to her in the twilight. His voice was low, and she had to strain to catch his words above the breeze. They were standing at the gable end of a shed. He said, "I want to kiss you, bog woman. I want to kiss your ears, your mouth, your neck, your nipples, your belly, your thighs, your cunt. Especially your cunt, where I can taste the way you fucked me." She knows that if she told someone, they'd say she dreamt it all in some mad dream. But this was not a dream. This has a taste beyond imagination. Another time, a long way from home and from the things that were familiar, she saw an African woman at a bus stop on the King's Road. It was summertime. The woman's skin reminded her of how the evening sky dilutes in bog pools, letting its colour linger with the promise of long days still to come. And she walked up to the silent, motionless woman and touched the side of her shining face. And the woman smiled and held her hand for an enduring moment. Two souls at sea, each far from a homeland and from a time when life was more than simple memory. The warm earth that is hardly earth folds about the shadows of her skin. The sun's hotness draws blood to her face, but her vision remains dead to its light. A sudden breeze lifts and drops dark mould in pools that were and will be stagnant. The frozen heads of seeded cotton nod and check and nod again. The whole flat world is tanned. Even the glint of sun off water comes back mute. Her eyes are brown, her skin, her hair, her fingernails. She doesn't move. The kiss of heat smiles on her smiling mouth. This is called We Were Boys Then. I think it's probably fairly... Anyone's been to a boarding school. In fact, anyone's been to school at all who was a boy, or even maybe who was a girl, will probably hopefully get something out of this. We Were Boys Then. We were boys then, filled with the expectation of the age, fired by the vastness of the desert, by the voice in the burning bush, by the cross on the peak of the crooked hill. But now, we are these other people. Not the ghosts our fathers were, not old before our years. We are something else. Men trapped between a time that was and a future without certainty. What do we wish for ourselves? Long life and happiness? The peace to be at ease with what we've done or not undone? Some morsel from the plate of youth? The will to stay forever open to the possibilities of life and love, of the time we call tomorrow? And tonight? Perhaps tonight we wish beyond all else for the gift of memory, the strength to face the wilderness, and not allow our fearlessness become our fear. A way to be the boys we were back then. This is a poem called Brother. It's part of a sequence. I'm just going to read the first part of it. And it's in memory of my brother who died 11 years ago. And it seems like yesterday. But I was blessed to be with them when it happened. Brother. I am writing this poem in the pencil light from a hospital door. My brother lies sleeping, his lungs opened and shut by machinery. The shadow of my hand falls across this page, as the shadow of something less certain falls over his damaged body. I want to comfort him, to be the reassuring one as he so often was to me. He who always found a way round things, but not round this. In the car tonight on the 5-minute drive from his house to the hospital, I heard that song Daniel in the summer darkness. Dearest brother, only brother, I love you. For all the days we were together and all the times we were apart. Your kindness is a soft voice smiling down the telephone line, telling me everything will be all right. I wish I could say the same for you and know there was some truth in it. Instead, the night draws on and the moon retreats a degree or two, and we share this room as we once shared a room at home. You talking in one bed, me laughing in the other. We're both silent now, but for the drive and draw of air into your wounded lungs and the soft movement of my pen across the pages of what's left of our lives together. I close my eyes and hear the echo of your words, the memory of my laughter, that song coming in on the late night radio, its notes across the empty car park, its tenderness hanging in the slow Carolina night. And sticking with that cheerful theme, this is a poem about my father. About a year before my father died, his doctor suggested that he needed to go into hospital for some respite. And being the stubborn bugger he was against the idea, but he did go in, and I got the job of driving him to hospital. And this is a poem about that. It's called A Ghost in the Car. You need some respite, the doctor said. It's not just advisable, it's imperative. And I promise you'll be home in weeks. The clock ticked. The fire sang. I found my father waiting, available but not enthusiastic. A February afternoon, not quite ripe with spring. Familiar roads, the ones he'd driven 20,000 times, I reckoned, to work and home. The ones I'd shared in school days, allowed to steer the Morris Minor on the straight. A great silence remained unbroken as we edged through the afternoon traffic, over the Barrow Bridge and right onto the Stradbally Road. Finally, turning through the hospital gates, grey famine roof against the blue. Only then did he speak. "I never thought you would put me in the county home." To my father, this was still the workhouse, dumping ground for the unwanted, unrecognised, unkempt and undesired. He did come home that spring, but in the buried autumn he was back again. This time, I didn't have the heart or soul, what am I saying? I didn't have the courage to drive him there. I'd visit daily, the railway yard, the nurses joked. Three old men, 137 years of trains between them. Three rusting engines in the final siding. And this time, there was no going home. Some days, my father's ghost travels with me in my car. Some days we laugh. But some days he reminds me, and I shiver at the thought. Back sometime in the 1970s, I saw a piece of graffiti on a hoarding in Athy, where I lived at the time. And it stayed with me for about 25 years, and I finally got a haiku out of it. And the piece of graffiti said, "Ger loves Sally, so fuck off and leave them alone." And the haiku is, "Ger loves Sally, so fuck off and leave them alone. Dante, Beatrice." Those are some poems from Where Sadness Begins, and I was going to read some now from the current book, which is By the Light of Four Moons. Can I grab a chair?
You have to.
No? Yeah. Okay. By the way, thank you to Paul and everybody involved in Ovale. Neil Boyakis, delighted to be here. We have to leave immediately after this because we have to go back to Carlow and we have to get on the road at 5:30 in the morning for the
airport.
There's
always tomorrow.
There is always tomorrow. There's always tomorrow. That's why we have to get back. Anyway, some poems from that. This is a poem for Angela, who's over here. It's called Wife and Husband. We met about 6 years ago. Anyway, we got married last year. That's actually the year before last now, but anyway, it seems like last year. And this is a poem called Wife and Husband. "Wif," they said in Chaucer's time, "and husband, she being woman, female, lady, he being householder," and that was that. Two words that stretch across the centuries, uttering so little, yet whispering so much. And now, what do they mean? They mean that we have stepped out here today in the eyes of these our friends, from the journeys of the past, in the hope of consolation and a future with each other. They mean love in the jumbled way of letters. They mean the silence after disagreement and profounder silences of calm. They mean whatever things we choose to make them mean. And most of all, from here on in, they mean together, husband and wife. And this is a poem called A Wedding Song, which I wrote for my son, Ewan, and his wife, Erica. "May love be in your hearts like sunlight when sunlight is needed, like rain when there is need of rain. May it be ordinary, a chair on which to sit, a table at which to eat, a bed on which to rest. May it not necessarily be the things you wish for, but instead the things you truly need. Sometimes our poverty becomes our blessing. May your love dress plainly and thrive on life's simplicity. The shoots of spring, the hedges of high summer, the fruits of autumn, the slow, soft dance of winter. May love be the branch that lends you shelter, the fireside at which you are forever welcome. May it be the house in which you live and the days in which you dwell. May love be your companion forever. I've long been fascinated by the shepherds who appear in the birth story in the New Testament, because they, no more than Joseph, the stepfather of Jesus, they appear and then they disappear. And I was kind of fascinated by them. And this is a poem, it's a version of one of the shepherd stories, and it's called The Shepherd Forgets the Angel's Song. Years afterwards, when days were little more than remembering, drifting from sleep to dreams in a room as far from the hills as summer is from rain, he tried to recollect the music. Was there some flaw in his mind? Or had the verses truly been discordant? A tune that burned the ear, a mad cacophony of broken song. And when he woke at night, aware of sounds outside, carts on the rattling street, voices late and early, struggling from the inns or on their way to work, he could never quite regain the words they'd used. What he found instead were soft, mist-haunted hills, and above them an enormous sky filled with moving stars. A silence, deeper, fuller, sweeter than any music ever heard or imagined. This is a poem based on events reasonably close to where we live, and well, two separate sets of events, but that they're here as a coalition, if that's not a dirty word, in one poem. And it's a poem about that situation sometimes when you're faced with a friend's or a neighbour's tragedy, and you want to do something to help, but you don't know what to do. And this is a poem called At the Gate of the Hanged Boy's House. There was nothing else they could do without intruding. And they wanted, more than that, they needed to do something. They had known the boy, not as well as they knew his father, but known him nonetheless in the way men in their 40s grudgingly know teenage boys. So one of them rolled out a floodlight from his shed and checked the generator and checked the cables and waited for the others to arrive. One brought yellow jackets, gaudy, reflective skins of waterproof. And they manhandled generator and lights into a field at the end of the long drive, inside the gate of the Hanged Boy's house, and set themselves to traffic management. All night the mourners came. All night these men stood in the freezing rain, directing cars into functioning ranks, making this one thing easier, this one thing they could do. And all night the generator hummed, and the traffic came and went, drowning the silence that had drowned the house that day. Photographer. The photographs I love the most are these, the fading faces of all lovely ghosts who came alive to music. Here they dance again, smiles trapped within the glad confusion of a time stood still. And here they are in gardens overgrown now, bright flowers gone to seed. Old apples fallen or grown small with time and setting suns. The camera shutter closes in another age. The formal faces scowl or smile or are perplexed. Or someone shifts and slips forever into rushed uncertainty. A but the face behind the camera. The eyes that peered and framed, the hands that froze that moment for a century, remain unseen. Who recorded this, or this, or this? Who framed the picture of that family against the deep of rhododendron? Who chose the moment to say, smile? Some man, some woman whom we never see. Some blessed figure crouched behind the camera, who stilled these forms and faces for a century, who made, but always stood outside the history.
In a previous life, I was a secondary school teacher, and I had one class of boys and girls. There were 21 of them in it, and within 5 years of their leaving cert, six of them were dead, which is quite bizarre. Most of them killed off bikes, and one chap who survived the motorcycle accident lost both his legs in it. But just last year, the year before last, I was at his funeral, and it got me thinking about that class, and this is the poem called Bikers. And they had actually, for his funeral, this group of bikers had assembled on the cemetery road in Castlemarket, where I grew up. Bikers. The bikers have assembled on the cemetery road. Machines squat silent in the quiet of the day. An hour from now, they'll rev a lengthy, blaring convoy. But here, the raucous engines only glint, mute swans. Assembled at the graveside, the blazing leathers catch what's left of this year's sun, hard helmets like bouquets upon their arms. Do I sense the others too? The ones who had no more than months to live, when they, impatient for the highway dream, took flight from school. Their lives were ambushed by stone walls, dark trailers on the narrow winter roads, and corkscrew bends that turned an unexpected twist too far. They closed their eager eyes on gravel furrowed with their bone, against the chrome and glass of half-expected cars, in fields beyond vague hedges on sleepy summer nights. Did I sense them today? Or is that some hunger from the past, some despondent hope that we might gather all alive their Monday morning books again, unopened mysteries? Ecumenics. I don't know if any of you grew up, well, no, you're probably all too young, but if anyone grew up in an Irish village in the 60s, as I did, ecumenics were kind of unheard of. Ecumenics. They were Church of Ireland, the girls we fantasized about. Or Presbyterian or Methodist, we couldn't tell the difference. They lived on farms on the hills above the village that was ours. Apart from one, the shopkeeper's daughter. I saw her every day that summer when I collected my parents' morning paper, half hoping she'd serve me, terrified she might. They were driven through the village every Friday night of that long, hot, hopeless season, on their way to rugby clubs and cinemas, while we hung around the laurels, wondering. At Christmas time, their boyfriends came from Trinity and took them off to parties in big houses at the ends of tree-lined drives. We sat on the bridge at Farrelly's, immobilized by fear and something else. A presence that was deeper, darker than the winter night. An attendance on which I still can't put a name. I have to tell you a secret. I left my glasses at home, and luckily Angela remembered there was this pair, which I was told by the optician not to wear again. But they're working, more or less. Anyway, how to isolate a field.
To begin, you need the help of someone else. A man who shuffled on blistered mornings to an outside tap and basin and threw up ditches for a landlord while his colleague watched. Then you need trains to connect points A and B, and some slick developer whose calluses are manicured with profit and distance, who will slice the thick ditches and push in garages between the semis and the trees. And then you need the council with a service road, and afterwards you need the everyday essentials, an off license, a bookie shop, a chic hairdresser. But most of all, you need a farmer who says no, who holds on, manoeuvring his tractor past the bull-barred jeeps on October afternoons. Now you've isolated your field, but someone still remembers it for what it's truly worth. Just three more. This one is called Not. And it's written for two friends of ours, Eileen and Joe. Not. It is all right to say fuck everything as loudly as you need. To not present the public face. Not be the smiling one who's getting on with it. It's okay not to care just who thinks what. To no longer have the energy for anything. It is enough to simply be untouchable, unreachable, to live inside the hole that is a heart, to be asleep, to be afraid, to be a mirror of the blindly casual death that stole so great a part of you as well. There may not be light this dawn, and the bluest sky can throb a paler shade of grey. The essential thing for now maybe not to go on. To stop instead, because you must. Because there is no place to go, and none to go there with. And going on regardless is simply not enough. Finished two short poems. This is called St. Stephen's Night, and it's a memory of Denis O'Driscoll. Wonderful, wonderful poet. In fact, a wonderful man. Very gentle man. St. Stephen's Night. In fields, the moonlit pools were ghosts reclining on the frozen grass. Behind the darkened hedge, a swollen stream gurgled its late goodnight. And all the way home, on the shining, broken road, our shadows went before us. And finally, this is a very two very short poems. In fact, I'll read this one first, and then I'll go on. This is a little poem for Angela called Your Scarf. Your scarf over a chair back spills perfume in the night and across the years ahead, oh years of pure delight. Finally, this is a poem for a friend of mine, Jim Dunn, who's the local undertaker in Castle Durham. And I always remember the morning my father died. He said, "Will you come down, John, and have a look at the coffins?" And then he brought me into the showroom and he said, "This is the top of the range, it's what your father would have wanted." Of course, how do you get out of that one? Okay, the undertaker for Jim. Each time I pass the undertaker's store, I swear, I see him wink and gently smile. Behind him, through a widely open door, a vast array of coffins to beguile. Like invitations issued year on year to parties that are bound to end in tears. Thanks very much.